Hello and welcome to the IEA channel. I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications, and today we're going to be looking at socialism. Is it losing the battle but winning the war? The past month has seen major changes for flag bearers of socialism on both sides of the Atlantic. Bernie Sanders, self-described democratic socialist, withdrew from the race for the White House, while in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn stepped down as leader of the Labour Party after almost 5 years at the helm. Yet neither are pessimistic about the future of their movement. Not only are we winning the struggle ideologically, said Sanders in his concession speech, we are winning generationally. In the aftermath of December's crushing general election defeat, Jeremy Corbyn claimed that the left had actually won the argument, just not won at the ballot box. Both were derided, but actually, have they got a point? Fewer than 1 in 12 people have positive associations with the word capitalism. Only 1 in 20 believe that healthcare and education should be privately provided, and fewer than 1 in 20 want the state to be any smaller than it currently is. Capitalism is tolerated but not celebrated, while socialism has become cool. Sweeping across social media and university campuses, packing out town halls and market squares with huge crowds, could electoral success actually be unnecessary for socialists? Joining me today to discuss this are Mark Littlewood, Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs, and Dr. Christian Niemitz, Head of Political Economy and author of Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Emma.
Thank you. Hello.
Given the recent general election landslide by the Conservative Party in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn stepping down as leader, Bernie Sanders pulling out of the race for the White House, does that mean socialism's over? Is it failed? Christian, we'll start with you.
No, it doesn't mean that. I don't see these recent events as defeats. We have to bear in mind where these movements are coming from. 5 years ago, socialism was associated with fringe groups like the Socialist Workers Party. If the Socialist Workers Party or a group like that had won a third of the vote in a general election, nobody would have said, this is a crushing defeat for socialism. This is a clear rejection of socialism by the British electorate. We would have seen that as a massive victory for socialism. And I think this is the right way to look at this. And the same is true in the media landscape. 5 years ago, if you had been a self-described Marxist, your media platform would probably have been a column in the Socialist Worker. Now it means pretty much a guaranteed slot on Question Time, on Politics Live, on Good Morning Britain, and so forth. So the media profile has massively increased, and the share of people who are prepared to vote for a socialist program has massively increased. I think that they have every right to be optimistic.
Mark, do you agree with Christian?
A little, yes. I mean, I don't think we should read too much into two political personalities, Sanders and Corbyn, and assume that the help or otherwise of an ideology is directly linked to their electoral performance, because there are a huge number of other things associated with electoral performance, their ability to raise money, how charismatic they are on the television. None of those are ideological points. And I do agree with Christian that if 10 years ago you'd even suggested that Bernie's, or maybe 15 years ago, you'd suggested that Bernie Sanders could make a serious run for the White House and that Jeremy Corbyn would be the leader of the Labour Party through two elections, that would have been considered absolutely ludicrous as a prediction. I mean, the odds that you would have got on that, them rising as high as they did, would have been very, very long odds indeed. So I think for most ideologies, you actually have to cross the chasm in several leaps. And if you like, the far left, as Christian has said, has become part of the political establishment. It's become a major part of major mainstream parties, the British Labour Party and the US Democrats. Where I part company with Christian a little, but I think only a little, is on the media presence of the left. I think it is true that those of a fairly far-left doctrine are more frequently on our television screens. And I think broadcasters would have justified that because of the ideological nature of the Labour Party under Corbyn. You know, the opposition leader believes these sort of ideological ideas. Therefore, we want a range of people who share them on the media. That might decline somewhat. But I also generally think over the past decade or so, it's been easier for people with radical ideas, including libertarians from the IEA, by the way, to get a media platform. So I'm not sure that's unique to socialism. They may have benefited from the rise of Corbynism and the rise of Sanders, and being sort of outriders for that, fellow travellers for that. But more generally, I actually think the media landscape is now open to a much wider range of what people would consider weird and wacky opinions. And of course, a good number of people would consider the sort of opinions put forward by the IEA to be weird and wacky. But we certainly have a much greater media presence than we did 10 years ago, and we are certainly not Marxists.
Very good point. Christian, you've written about your belief that socialism might fail in the short term and fail in an electoral sense, but win the long game. You've used the example of Extinction Rebellion as well, that they might actually win the argument, but not necessarily in the short term. Can you explain why you think that's the case?
Because there are lots of groups that are clearly influential, but that are not and have never been successful in an electoral sense. The climate strikes movement around Greta Thunberg is a good example here. That is a movement which is purely extra parliamentary. They don't have a party political arm. And if they set up a party of their own and ran in a general election, we wouldn't expect them to do well. But nonetheless, why would they run for office? They're getting everything they want already. The government has already put forward this completely uncosted net zero target. They get pretty much everything they want. Or if you look at the various nanny state neo-temperance campaign groups that keep our colleague Chris Snowden busy, these groups don't have a political party that they're attached to. If they set up a party of their own, if they ran for office, they would lose. There's no way that a party like that would be electorally successful. But nonetheless, why would they? They're getting everything they want. They're getting their display bans, their sin taxes, their advertisement bans, whatever they and that reformulation, whatever they're asking for, they're getting it anyway. And another example that's possibly closest to the socialism case would be Euroscepticism, because Euroscepticism has never been electorally successful either, at least not at the Westminster level. We've never had a strong Eurosceptic party that did well in general elections. UKIP only ever had two MPs, and they were both defectors from a mainstream party, but nonetheless, they got their way. We have left the EU now. Eurosceptics have won. And I think what happened there, and that's pretty much the same thing as with socialism. The reason why Euroscepticism was not a main thing, say, 8 years ago, not a mainstream cause, was not that the majority of the public loved the EU, that there was much support for EU integration. It was more that you had a minority of people who were fiercely against the EU, and many others who tolerated it, thought it wasn't really that important, didn't like it, but it wasn't their main priority. And that's pretty much exactly where we are now with socialism and capitalism. We have a group of passionate supporters of socialism, not a majority, not enough to win a general election, but a passionate minority anyway. And we have virtually nobody who passionately supports capitalism. I mean, that's what all the surveys show. There are plenty of people who accept capitalism, who think, well, can't be bothered to think about an alternative. But the sort of passionate support for capitalism, that you see this as not just a necessary evil, but something that you would ideally want to have more of, that view is only held by a vanishingly small number of people.
I mean, Mark, people who work at the IEA probably are, I mean, hopefully part of that vanishingly small number. Why do you think that there's not many of us and there seems to be a lot of very passionate socialists?
Well, I agree with Christian, but only up to a point. And I mean, you'd expect people who work in think tanks to point out, as Christian does, I think very compellingly in his CapEx article, which I'm sure will be in the show notes below, that it's wrong, naive, or far too binary to see political power and influence just through the ballot box. It's not just a question of which party and which colour rosette accrues which number of votes to win an election. Political power is much more dispersed than that. And pressure groups and think tanks and community organisations and the rest can have a huge impact on the political process. And I roughly agree with those that Christian has highlighted, Extinction Rebellion. The Eurosceptic movement, by and large, was a non-electoral force, right? I mean, it was, OK, you had UKIP as a political party, but you had a plethora of organizations and campaign groups and research institutes that were continually reiterating the argument. So I agree, and indeed it's almost a raison d'etre for think tanks, that the aim is to be a relatively small force in terms of the resources in front of you and to shift the overton window. And political parties are more sort of prisoners of the overall landscape than they are the creators of it. They react to other forces like Greta or like Nigel Farage tipping the seesaw. And even though Greta and Nigel may never assume high levels of power themselves, they can actually tip the seesaw, and the people who are actually in power may well bend to their will. Just a point on the electoral side of this stuff, where again I slightly question Christian's critique, is I think you can have electoral power without winning an election, right? So if you like, the legacy of UKIP or the Brexit Party is they can certainly say mission accomplished, and other than doing well in Euro elections and of course contributing to winning the referendum, Christian's absolutely right. I mean, their performance in a general election, I think they've only ever won one seat in a general election, and that was Douglas Carswell, a defecting Conservative. But they were able to stack up a substantial proportion of the vote. And if as an electoral force, you're burrowing your way into the natural audience of another group, that group then needs to move in your direction. So I actually think that, you know, although they were never going to win an election, UKIP, the fact that the Conservative Party seemed to be alive to the fact that they could lose large numbers of votes for this fringe party tends to move that party in that direction. I would posit that if, for example, the US Libertarian Party could get a meaningful share of the vote in a presidential election, falling well short of winning it, but if they could get, say, 10% of the vote, that would have an impact on probably moving the Republican Party in a Libertarian direction. So figures that fall short of actually winning, even potentially fall short of winning any seat or any representation, can still have influence on the overall outcome. In terms of how vanishingly small are we, I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I, but kind of be skeptical of opinion polls. I actually think socialism is much more popular as a state preference than a revealed preference. I think capitalism has become a term which is, in most people's mind, synonymous with the status quo. Do you like the status quo? It's not synonymous with a kind of free market, ideological, Hayekian or Friedman-esque kind of view of the world. So are you happy with capitalism is really interpreted, I think, by most people to be, are you happy with the status quo? And I can see why a good number aren't. And all sorts of socialist projects are popular in opinion polls. I mean, they might be extremely so now, but this has often been the case. If you look at polling in the times of Thatcherism around, do you want to privatise, you know, British telecom, do you want to privatise British Airways, do you want to privatise British gas? Not much sign of big popular support, even on council house sales. So as a stated preference, free markets are not very popular. As a revealed preference, however, free markets are very popular. When you actually give people the option to buy their council house or the option to buy shares in the public utility they were working in, the applications flood in. They just don't seem to stack up in an opinion poll. And I think that's, I mean, I'm hoping I'm using that in an optimistic way for free market liberals such as us. But I think it's a very important, if I'm right, strategic insight that we shouldn't worry as much as we sometimes do that the opinion polls show that 75% of people want to nationalise X or 192% of people are against the privatisation of Y. I actually think that often free market reforms are unpopular in contemplation, but very popular in effect.
So we can be optimistic for the future. That's good to hear. Socialists often claim that they've got the young on their side. I mean, the quote I gave earlier from Bernie Sanders saying they won the argument generationally and that they're destined to win in the long term. A lot of people on the right tell themselves or believe that socialism is just a phase that young people go through. It's just kid being kids and they'll grow out of it. Do you think that's right? Or do you think people are being naive, Mark?
There's a bit of truth in that. I think that it tends to be that younger people are a more ideological, so less likely to be conservative in the literal sense of the word, not in the party political sense, but are more likely to have wild, weird, wacky, radical, utopian ideas about how the world can be. I think there are also some practical elements of capitalism or the way our broadly market economy operates that they escape. So I always reminisce about the polemicist P.J. O'Rourke's interview about this. I believe it was the late, great Clive Anderson who was interviewing him. And Anderson thought that he'd nailed O'Rourke. He sort of said he was going to try and prove a discrepancy in O'Rourke's political ideology. And he sort of, the interview went something like this. He said, "So, Mr. O'Rourke, you know, when you were 19 years old, you were the editor of the Revolutionary Workers Communist monthly magazine on your campus. And you were the vice conciliary of the Socialist Workers Revolutionary Group, blah, 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 blah. You gave money to this, that, and the other. By 1980, you were a registered Republican and donated money to Ronald Reagan's campaign. What happened?" He replied, "I got a job." And now I don't mean that in a demeaning way to young people, actually. Mm-hmm. But I do think that once you start seeing taxing the amount of tax that you're having to pay out of your work, crucially, I think when you're a property owner, you're more likely to be in favour of the broad capitalist structure. We've got a huge problem there because young people, for reasons that Christian has researched in depth and is much more eloquent on than I am, aren't getting on the property ladder. So if you like, those who don't have a stake in the system are more likely to be radically opposed to the system. And young people, by and large, don't have the same sort of stake in the system. Students have not yet entered the labour market. Our particular problems, because of our planning restrictions, they're not tending to get on the property ladder. So if you want people to be capitalists, they've got to have some capital. I hate the term stakeholder society, but there is an element to that, that once you've got an income and a share portfolio and a private pension and a property, you take a very different view, and I think likely a more free market view in your own self-interest about what should prevail. Whereas if you're a student, you know, engaged in your day-to-day activity as philosophizing about how the world should be, and you aren't paying income tax or property taxes, you're not that bothered about how the particular number of the FTSE 100 hits you today, you're more likely to be lefty and radical. So I think it's an endemic point, but I think it's been exacerbated by our failure to see wage growth, and in particular, our failure to get young people onto the property ladder.
Christian, what do you think? Because, I mean, that's generally a point that, you know, as Mark is rightly pointing out, it's hard to be a capitalist when you don't have any capital. So perhaps when young people start to feel the effects of capitalism, they'll see the benefit. But, you know, to go back to Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn, they're not young men, but, you know, they didn't grow out of it. So do you think it is something that passes, or do you think, are you a bit more worried about how popular socialism is across the generations?
Well, it's certainly not something that passes automatically. Bernie himself and Corbyn himself are maybe atypical. It's true that for the baby boomer generation, you can make that case. A lot of them were student radicals in the 60s, were flirting with Maoism and Ho Chi Minhism. But these people are now retired, and there aren't that many Maoist pensioners in Britain. So they clearly didn't stay that way. For them, it was a phase. But you can't automatically assume that every generation will replicate that pattern. And actually, the writer Ed West has looked at this. He's similarly pessimist as I am. And he says, yes, this was true for previous generations, that you had this pattern and outburst of radicalism in the younger years. But he says already for Generation X, if you look at longitudinal attitude studies, you don't see a trajectory like that. If anything, they've become a bit more left-wing over time. And for the millennial generation, the problem here is that people often seem to use millennials as a synonym for teenagers. Millennials are people who were born in the 80s and 90s. That means that the oldest cohorts of the millennial generation are pushing 40 now. The average millennial would be around 30 years old in their early 30s. If you haven't grown out of socialism by that age, when will you? If this were really just 18-year-olds, then I would totally agree with that assessment. Then I would say, yeah, well, let them get a job. Let them be in an environment where they're not constantly surrounded by age mates, by peers, where they feel they have to adopt political views, maybe for performative reasons to fit in, because that's the cool belief. If it were just that, fair enough. But what the attitude surveys show is that, yes, it is related to age, but it's not that it suddenly declines when once people hit their mid-20s or so. If anything, it's more like mid-40s or so. You have to get to that stage. It is the millennial generation and the younger cohorts of Generation X who are fairly socialist. You have to go fairly high up the age distribution before you find cohorts who are really, on average, staunchly anti-socialist. It's really just the over 65-year-olds.
The people who remember the 70s, as we like to point out. What do you both think the future holds for socialists? I mean, Mark, you've said you don't put much stall by, you know, looking purely politically, because that's only part of the picture. But I mean, it's a difficult time to be asking either of you to make predictions. But what do you think the next sort of 10 years holds when it comes to socialism? Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm I think Christian makes some fair points, but on the spectrum of optimist to pessimist, from a perspective of a market liberal, I'm less pessimistic than he is. Christian Fine's calls in his CapEx article to agree with Owen Jones, something I never thought I would see, but only agreeing with Owen Jones on Owen's optimism about the future of socialism and how socialist ideas are being picked up, not just by far left parties, by mainstream left parties, and by some parties on the right. And I'm interested in Christian's idea that that you can be a non-parliamentary force and shape politics. That's really true. And I'm interested in his examples around Euroscepticism and Extinction Rebellion. But I think socialism runs into a problem, because I think if you were to say Euroscepticism and Extinction Rebellion, Extinction, both have had massive policy victories without being political parties. I think the trick that they had in common, those two very different political forces, was that they came across as just sort of talking common sense, really, that it was sort of increasingly normal to agree with them. So Eurosceptic cases about, we just want Britain to run its own affairs. You'd have to be a mad ideologue to think differently, or in the pocket of Brussels to think differently. We're asking for something very simple and straightforward that average Joe would completely agree with. Similarly, Extinction Rebellion, I mean, I haven't seen any polling on exactly how many people agree and disagree with them. I don't think we should claim that Extinction Rebellion have completely taken the world by storm. But the sympathy with them is the planet's going to go up in flames, or underwater, I'm not sure which it is, by 2050, unless we do A, B, C, D, E. It's urgent that we do A, B, C, D, E. If you don't agree with us, you're dicing with death and the end of humanity. Socialism, I think, hasn't quite caught that sort of normal common sense view that actually, oddly enough, the highly diverse Eurosceptic movement and Extinction Rebellion have managed to communicate. And the third example that Christian gives of the nanny state stuff, the success of really very small pressure groups and lobby organizations to bring in a whole plethora of interventions around lifestyle, I think that's in a slightly different category, because with the honorable exception of Chris Snowden and a handful of others, it's not a very salient issue. Most people don't care very much how their sweets are packaged, or whether cigarettes are sold under the counter or over the counter, or what the health warning is on a packet of cereal. Whereas socialism, whether we live in a socialist or a capitalist economy, whether we are members of the European Union or not, whether we remove carbon entirely from our economy, these are very, very big issues. So I don't think they can follow the nanny state method of having a sort of few insiders who are sort of cunningly advising a few key policy people in the right departments. And as of yet, I don't think that the socialist movement has rendered itself mainstream. In fact, I think it's rendered itself quite toxic to the extent that whilst it strongly appeals to, let's say, I'm not saying this is the polling, but let's say 25% of people, it's made itself less attractive to the other 65%. It hasn't found people in the middle. And I think you can see some electoral evidence of this in the UK, that the median voter in the United Kingdom was not inspired by Jeremy Corbyn's programme, far from it. Jeremy Corbyn's programme probably made that median voter much less likely to vote for the Labour Party than almost any other general election you can imagine. So I'm not sure that the socialist movement, if with a change of leadership in the Labour Party, it becomes a non-party movement, will necessarily replicate Extinction Rebellion and the Eurosceptics. I think they have not made themselves, if you like, mainstream and normal enough to achieve that yet.
Christian, this is your specialist subject. We'll give final words to you. What do you think the future holds for socialists?
Well, I'm generally pessimistic about those trends. Well, as you've gathered, by that, I don't mean that I'm expecting us to become the North Korea of the North Sea. We're not going to see a wholesale socialist takeover. But what will happen, what is already happening, is that free market liberalism becomes toxic, and people elsewhere on the political spectrum, on the right in particular, feel the need to distance themselves from it. That is something that you see already. There's barely a day goes by when you don't have an article in the Telegraph or the Times about some right-leaning thinker saying, we need a new social contract. We need to reinvent capitalism. And by that, they always seem to mean in a more interventionist direction. And in that sense, socialists are setting the overall tone that a right-wing thinker would feel the need to distance themselves from market liberalism. That is the way in which they signal, I'm thoughtful, I'm not one of those horrible people, I'm on the right, but not in the bad way. So sort of Tim Montgomery was maybe a bit ahead of this. He had his The Good Right project 10 years ago or so, and that now seems to be the mood on the right more generally. And I think that's the direction we're going in. On the point that Mark raised, that Eurosceptics, environmentalists are good at portraying themselves as the common sense perspective, but some of the socialists are good at that too. Not the ones who can't get away from the pure Marxist jargon, but the Owen Joneses of the world have this narrative that they say, well, we just want the economy to be more democratic. What could be wrong with that? Isn't that a common sense perspective? We have a political democracy. Why not an economic democracy? Why not democracy in the workplace, democracy about consumption and production? Isn't that a common sense perspective? That's the way they argue, and that sounds superficially plausible.
So obviously the way to combat this is that the people watching this subscribe to the YouTube channel and give more money to the IEA. We've got to turn this tank around.
That's exactly right, yeah.
You've just negated the need for me to end this podcast at all. Just Mark saying, just donate to the IEA. It's basically the answer. If you're interested in learning more about how socialism has failed, Christian's book, Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies, is available on the IEA website or via Amazon. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the IEA's YouTube channel, our IEA daily newsletter, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to never miss a moment.